This podcast is brought to you by Soapbox. Start your own podcast today at www.soapbox.host.
Welcome back to Season 2, Episode 13 of Wednesday at 9 p.m., where we have Part 2 of The Bell Witch, where we'll hear the harrowing end of the tale, the prophecy of Kate's return, and the sad ending that faced Betsy and John Sr. Joining me, as always, are Nick and Aaron. Welcome back, men. I feel like I last recorded with you so soon, so recently. How are you doing?
Doing good.
Weeks go by.
Yes, I feel like it's been less than a week.
As the days gone by.
All right, that's all we can legally sing, Nick.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, yeah.
You don't want to get DMAC'd.
I'm excited to finish the story. So really quick, we'll do shout-outs. Shout-out to Sarah, as always. I hope she listens to this two-parter. I hope anyone does. On to you, Nick.
Shout-out to Maddie, to my mother, who my mom will definitely listen to this. She's all caught up.
Wonderful.
And shout-out to David Hoy. Again, we know you're out there. Mainly because of your LinkedIn.
And you, Aaron?
Shout out to Fallon, of course. And a shout out to Troy from Nick. And lastly, shout out to the long lost forgotten bell that Frank probably won't address. Taco bell.
Yes. Very, family cat.
I was going to say the Nazi bell, which is a whole other story about, like, is it time travel or something? I don't know. Time travel. Yeah.
Yep.
You think I'm that clever, Frank? I'm thinking Taco Bell's the funniest thing. So
it'd be weird if you thought the Nazi Bell was funny.
That's true. So we last left off with the name Kate for the entity that was bugging and abusing the bells. And again, this was a little throwaway line that the spirit said, "Oh, I'm Kate Batt's witch." People started calling it Kate. There's really no reason to believe that it was telling the truth. But from this point on, the rest of this episode, we will call it Kate. So again, at this point, it's a full disembodied voice that can move things, can slap people, can grab people. Mostly does those physical things at night when the lights are off, but speaks to people during the day, has dozens of visitors from the nearby region and faraway places, much to the chagrin of the family who is housing them and feeding them out of pocket. Betsy and John Sr. are facing the brunt of the abuse. So soon after this name drop of Kate, we have some very bizarre visitors enter the stage. I guess that one disembodied voice was not enough, because Kate seemed to invite a troupe of four characters purporting together to be a, quote, witch family, each with their own voice and personality. The names they gave were Black Dog, Mathematics, Cypography, and Jerusalem. So up until this time, Kate had spoken in the same soft, delicate, feminine voice. Of course, except for when she was impersonating someone. But now, there were four different voices. Black Dog, who seemed to be the head of this witch family, spoke in a harsh, feminine tone. Mathematics and Cypography had their own more delicate feminine tones, and Jerusalem had a boy's voice. Remember that. I'm going to pause right there because what I just said is insane. What do we think of those names?
Black Dog really makes sense.
So does Mathematics.
I love Cypography. It sounds like a cool username I'd come up with as like a 12-year-old and like stick with and like try to make my own word for like something that just sounds cool. Because I mean, this is not a real word as far as I can tell.
Like a, It sounds like a magic system that Ben Sanderson made up.
That's actually so true. I would love if someone like puts a reference to a magic system or like a spell or something in something, some media that's named after this.
Mm-hmm. Nick, I'm getting some weird Mageddon vibes from this, if you know what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
You know, his crew.
Yeah, that's true.
Is that Gravity Falls?
The end. The series finale, kind of triple episode.
Interesting.
Finale.
Is there a little witch family in that?
Well, I mean,
Bill Cipher has like a gang of other dimensional beings that are just partying, you know, because it's the end of the world for like humans.
Oh, okay. I think I remember this. I think I watched this some weeks ago. We finished the series. That's actually funny you say that, because these guys would launch into offensive, hideous tirades.
Well,
uttering vile threats to each other, the family, and any visitors. Like the most obscene, blasphemous stuff would be screamed out loud and at each other.
For a PG rating, we can't say this.
Yes. No, we cannot. And as you can probably imagine, this was so terrifying to the family that John Bell Sr. would have moved. They were ready to move. But Kate had sworn to haunt and abuse John till the day he died. There was nowhere to go, because Kate promised to follow old Jack to the, quote, remotest part of the earth. And given the demonstrations Kate had provided, he believed it. So he kind of just had to deal with it, and the family had to tough it out.
But they didn't, though. He could have just like gone away.
So previously Betsy would go to other houses and it would follow her. So
yeah, but that was before the promise that the spirit was going to haunt old.
Yes. Dad. I mean, even so, that's even more reason to believe it would follow them. No.
Well, if follow him.
Oh, you think he should have left?
Haunt him
for the safety of his family. Left.
Yeah, be the hero.
That's an interesting idea. I think if it was only attacking him, he seems like the sort of guy that definitely would have done that. But it was also focusing on Betsy, and she was getting so ill, she was almost on. She almost died multiple times. So I think that's probably why he didn't just get up and leave, because it wasn't just on him. That's a good point. And also their son Joel faced a lot of the abuse as well, just like punching and slapping and strangling and stuff. At this point, with these crazy voices screaming and saying terrible things, a lot of visitors and friends abandoned the family, pretty terrified at the aggressiveness. But a few close friends and families never gave up on the Bells and never abandoned them. This included some of the names that we've heard, like the Johnsons, the Reverends, and so on. But imagine, I mean, how disturbing, just how bizarre and disturbing this would be. You'd either think that there was something demonic, or that family was just insane, right? The witch family would argue with each other. They would sing songs of all kinds, especially blasphemous ones. And they would make noises like drunk men fighting. So people in this house would hear noises all around them as if there were four drunk men beating each other up. And they couldn't see anything, just disembodied sounds coming from all around them. This is funny as well. Black Dog would play Peacemaker. And he would threaten the others with violence and curses if they didn't behave. And at times there were sounds of him violently beating Jerusalem when he didn't obey. And on one occasion, explain this, the voices came and sounded terribly drunk, and they filled the Bell House with the scent of whiskey. And they claimed they got the bottle of whiskey at the nearby John Gardner's house. But other times they'd
Joshua
be
Joshua Gardner's dad.
Yes, yes. And other times they would just be calm and civil and would treat the company to delightful singing with sweet tones. Supposedly they sang so sweetly, I mean, they'd bring people to tears at times. So it's like swinging back and forth, back and forth. Kate is sweet sometimes and nice, and sometimes slapping people across the face. We'll have some more stories of stuff during this time, but this didn't last too long, this period, and eventually the concerts were kind of the end of the activity of this witch family, and they slowly died off until just Kate remained. After this is a section I'm not going to go deep into, because it turns out that Kate was virulently racist. Yes, this disembodied voice had very strong opinions on certain racial groups in 1800s America. If you want to read more on that, you can go to the PDF in the show notes on page 135 of An Authenticated History of the Bell Witch and read it. And I will just warn, very strong language and old school language in that chapter. Yeah, pretty uncomfortable read in the public area I was in while researching this. Now, people also saw strange beings and animals that they associated with her, but there typically wasn't like a human form that clearly was Kate. Maybe the child in the trees from the very, very start. Maybe he was related to her, but it was never really clear. And at this time, some people really paid attention to Kate and tried to develop an understanding with her. And those who engaged with her were judged by Kate as either being honest and pure of heart or conniving. And she would praise and lather compliments on the people that she liked, and she would abuse verbally and physically the people that she didn't like. When I read this and how she made choices of who was good, who was bad, it really seemed more to me like it was just whoever was scared of her and didn't try to cross her and, like, you know, accuse her of being evil got the thumbs up, and whoever was at all critical or skeptical got the thumbs down and abuse.
Mm. Did anyone get a middle thumb?
Some people got a thumb up. No. Yes, Betsy sometimes would be like soothed and like her hair would be pet and like, and other times she'd literally just be slapped around silly. So it was really back and forth. But for the dad, John Bell Sr., always hatred, just out of nowhere, hatred. Basically saying, I'm going to kill you. I will not leave till you're dead. I'm going to kill you.
I wonder if, you know, maybe the thumbs up, thumbs down also correlated to like favorites. Like maybe the spirit was going after Betsy because it was like the favorite of the dad.
That's really insightful, Aaron. She definitely was like the favorite and all the attention was on her. There might be something to that.
Like maybe it was never after Betsy. It was after old Jack the whole time. And the way to get to him and really mess with him is to mess with his favorite.
That's so interesting that you say that. I didn't write down these notes, but I really do want to talk and I'll entered here. This whole time from childhood, Betsy and Joshua Gardner, who was a local boy, I think he's turned up once or twice in the stories, had really fallen in love, like childhood sweethearts, age 12, 13. He might have been a year or two older. And everyone knew it. They were pretty oblivious that they were being so obvious about it, but they were very clearly star-crossed lovers. They planned to get married, you know, when they got older. Except for Kate. for some reason, after originally encouraging it and doing stuff like shoving them outside when he was over so they can like go on walks together alone and stuff like that, there came to a point where the spirit changed its mind and decided it could not allow Betsy to marry Joshua Gardner. And it became one of its two main objectives, it seemed. The first being the destruction of John Bell Sr. The second being preventing Betsy from marrying her childhood sweetheart. It wasn't ever clear why. There was never a reason given. And it caused unimaginable stress and devastation on Betsy, on Joshua Gardner, on the family, on everyone. It would violently abuse her and scream, "You cannot marry Joshua Gardner. You cannot marry Joshua Gardner." It would beg at times in a sweet voice, incessantly saying, "Oh, please don't marry Joshua. Please don't marry Joshua. Please don't marry Joshua," for hours and hours on end. And whenever he came around, it would abuse her. And it basically never let her alone. I wonder how that fits in with like, I don't know. I mean, what do you make of that, Aaron? Just because that's,
I mean, I think it's clear cut, Frank. When you get married back in the day, you know, the daughter leaves the home and goes to the husband's home. And so by taking away, like, if they got married, she would no longer be in the same household. And so therefore would not be able to be tormented by Kate.
Maybe.
So that's like, if she's the favorite of the family, that's a key torture piece for John Sr. that, you know, is removed from the equation. So it weakens Kate's powers.
That's an interesting idea, though. I see where you're getting at, though. It did abuse her even when she was in other homes. But yeah, I wonder if there is something about, like, I don't know, something about a marriage that would kind of break some metaphysical bond and like, but you know, yeah, I don't know. And we'll touch more on the sad ending of that tale, the end here, but back to kind of choosing favorites, the Johnson sons, John and Calvin, imagine being named John Johnson, regularly chatted with Kate and they often just discussed the phenomena with her. And one day they were discussing the slaps and the blows that people would felt. And they were talking about how, like, people would see handprints and they were curious if Kate had hands. And so they asked Kate, they said, "Hey, let us shake your hand." Kate trusted this son, Calvin, as being just simply curious, no funny business. And so she acquiesced and he held out his hand. And without seeing anything, obviously, he felt the pressure and the grip of a soft and delicate woman's hand. And then his brother John was like, "Okay, my turn, let me try." But Kate saw right through him and said, "No, you only want a chance to catch me." And even when John vowed that he wouldn't, she said, "I know you, Jack Johnson. You are a grand rascal trying to find me out, and I won't trust you." So, even in that, she has this sense of like, who is a little bit smarter and will try to trap her or learn more about her than she wants to reveal. She knows how to keep those people at like an arm's length. Other people claimed to shake her hand as well and, you know, felt the same, a woman's hand. More and more stories of her knowing people's histories came, and there'd be visitors from out of town. One day, a guy showed up, and as soon as he walked through the door, she said, "This is the grand rascal who stole his wife. He pulled her out of her father's house through a window and hurt her arm, making her cry." And then he whispered to her, "Hush, honey, don't cry. It will soon get well." And the man was dumbstruck, and he confirmed that was true years ago, back in whatever state he was from, that happened. Now, many who consider themselves skeptics started to hear about this story and would travel from afar to try to debunk the Bell Witch as hocus pocus.
Not associated with the movie.
Not associated. They actually would try to debunk the story as hocus pocus 2.
Ah, definitely not associated with that one.
And one such day, a good-looking gentleman named Mr. Williams, a professional detective, showed up, and he'd heard of this mystery, and he was an expert, so he said, in untangling mysteries, detecting jugglery. I love that word. Jugglery. Sleight of hand, illusions, etc. And he claimed, he boasted, he would easily expose the trickery behind Kate. So, you know, John Bell Sr. warmly welcomed him. And he said, stay as long as you need. And Mr. Williams yapped and yapped and yapped all day about his travel to distant lands, the many cases he debunked, and how certain he was that he would expose the trickery behind Kate before he left. What do you think Kate did here during the day while John Bell, while this detective was going on saying, yes, this is just trickery. This is just the family. This is a conspiracy. Do you think she went, I'll show you.
Beat up Betsy.
Did you say beat up Betsy?
Yeah. That's always a safe bet.
Yeah, good guess. Well, you said before that she didn't like people who were skeptical. So maybe she did stuff to him.
She did nothing all day. Not a word. A little scratch or a thump, maybe, here or there, but pretty much hid out all day, making Mr. Williams quite impatient. He got a little cocky, and speaking his mind more freely to everyone, because again, every day there were other people, he's like, yeah, this is proof. This is a family conspiracy made up for attention, for money. Clearly, the family actors are afraid to make any demonstrations while I'm here because I'd expose them so quickly. Now, John Bell Sr. was, you know, in some other part of the house at the time. And when he heard this, he was like, how dare this guy come to my house, accept my hospitality, my food, and now accuse me of doing this? You think I would do this to myself? So he, you know, he makes to go over and kick the guy out. Before he could, he hears Kate speak to him. Kate says, no, you don't, old Jack. Let him stay. I will attend to the gentleman and satisfy him that he is not as smart as he thinks. And so, John held his tongue and treated him nicely. And the anxiety in the house grew as everyone waited for something to happen. And for the rest of the night, until they went to sleep, nothing happened. Mr. Williams triumphantly proclaimed he was right. It was a family affair. He had proved it. And Mrs. Bell laid out straw mattresses for everyone. Mr. Williams took the biggest one, you know, given that he was so full of himself. They promptly went to sleep after extinguishing the lights. And no sooner had Mr. Williams fallen asleep when he found himself aggressively pinned down to the floor by some incredible force who he was totally unable to fight, even though he was quite well built. The witch scratched and pounded on him with a vengeance, cackling in his face as he yelped for help and mercy. And this is the sense of humor. Kate attacked just long enough to ask him, taunting him, which family member do you think is doing this? Laying into him again and again, just an unmerciful beating, making him plead for his life. Finally, a candle was lit and the attack immediately stopped. And it was only about 2 minutes. But Kate, now no longer quiet, was not done taunting him. And this poor guy was terrified. And he stayed up all night in the chair with the candle by his side lit, suffering just the taunting of Kate around him the taunting and ridicule, asking him which of the family it was, which one it was now, how long he was staying with them, how long was he, you know, did she have the pleasure of staying with him? He left before breakfast in the morning. At this point, she becomes more and more violent, beating the Bell's youngest son, Joel, regularly. One day, Shakers are coming to visit the Bell house. They live in the community. And the Bells hear the voice of one of their slaves that takes care of the dogs. And he hears the voice saying, "Go get them, go get them." Like rousing the dogs to go chase the Shakers on their horses. And they go outside and they're like, "Whoa, what? Why is he doing? What is he doing?" They see nothing. And they just hear Kate laughing as the Shakers are like galloping away for their life because the dogs were set after them. As the kids are walking to and from school, they see sticks and stones thrown at them, and they will mark them and throw them back and get them thrown back at them and see that it is the same sticks. Kind of smart. Anytime the kids would trip or stumble when they were walking outside, later in the day, Kate would claim responsibility for each of them, relating what happened to them in perfect detail. And this is cool. She'd claim to have taken the form of rabbits and other creatures. There's one story of one of the local bachelors in the town that one day was in his home alone and heard the voice of Kate say, I forget, his name was either Bennett or John, or, you know, they're all named John, whatever. It's like, "John, can I get in bed with you?" And he's like, "Only if you play nice." And she's like, "Okay, I promise." And he's laying in bed, and he watches as the bed sheet is drawn back and something slithers into the bed.
Say that.
And he sees not any physical, you know, animal, but he sees the movement of the sheets in the slithering as something that feels like a huge snake slithers and wraps up next to him. And in that moment, he realizes, wait a minute. This is the perfect opportunity. And he leaps up, grabbing the bed sheets together with the invisible Kate in the sheets, and runs for the lit fireplace in the bedroom, planning to throw her into the fire.
Okay.
But with every step he takes, the entity that he's holding grows heavier and heavier and starts to reek and smell of just the most foul death, rot. And before he can make it halfway to the fireplace, it's too heavy and too disgusting and he has to drop it.
Should have went to the gym more.
Honestly, he lost his chance. And Kate, you know, cackles at him and says, nice try. You know, punches him in the face and disappears.
Well,
so, despite all this terrible abuse, Kate had soft spots for some people, including Lucy Bell, the mother. For whatever reason, Kate always called her Old Luce and held her in high regard and never abused her. And admittedly, this is probably because Lucy was very scared of Kate and saw no use in antagonizing her. She just wanted her kids to be safe. So she was like, I can't make it better. I'm not going to make it worse. So she just was always kind to Kate. And evidently this even helped calm Kate down and lessen the abuse she gave to some family members at the time, because she didn't want to upset Luce because she liked Lucy. This didn't help though when she was abusing her husband, old Jack. He always got attacked.
I wonder. Now this could be far-fetched. I wonder if there's not some reasoning behind that soft spot, like Kate knows something maybe about the husband that isn't kosher, that, you know, she's trying to like be a home girl to Lucy and be like, I'll take care of it. Don't you worry.
Aaron, did you hear anything like a theory of that before, or are you coming up with that?
No, I'm coming up with that. I don't even have the notes.
That's cool. Open. There are people, and I didn't go down into this. There are questions about the validity of the sources that all say John Bell Sr. was a saint because they were written by his descendants that probably don't have an interest in saying, well, there was this one thing back in the day where
he was an alcoholic
and there was this little time.
He cheated.
I have heard that there were rumors, I don't know if it's confirmed, that way back in the day in North Carolina on their estate, he got in trouble with the law for killing one of his slaves or something.
Hmm.
So there are some things in his past, but when you read the books, they paint him out to be like the most a paragon
innocent
of Christian
fatherhood.
Fatherhood, of manhood, of virtue, taking care of his children, his family, his wife. It does make you wonder, Aaron. That's really I don't know. I really don't know. I guess we'll never know. But Lucy came down with a terrible sickness. Have you guys heard of pleurisy?
It sounds like a pill.
It does, right? It's an old condition, which I assume we don't really deal with anymore. But it's an inflammation of the pleura, which is a thin membrane surrounding the lungs.
Mm.
Probably pretty common back then. What can you do except try not to die from it and just rest? So she came down with this in 1820. So this has been going on for 3 years by this point. September 1820. When Lucy got sick, Kate became very sad and sympathetic, tending to her incessantly, and was sad when she felt ill and was happy when Lucy felt, you know, a little good that day. And it was like it was nice, but also kind of like almost mocking, but not like it was like a helicopter parent nonstop being like, how are you feeling? Oh, you're good. Oh, that's good. That's good. Oh, you're feeling bad. I'm so sorry. What can I do? But Lucy was just pretty scared and quiet. So she just accepted it and was kind and patient. But Kate would sing songs to her, which were, again, so beautiful that they'd bring everyone to tears. Yet Lucy's condition worsened, coming close to taking her life. And the doctors and family became very concerned. I can't help but wonder how much of this, oh my God, old Luce, you are so good. You're so good. Are you okay? How can I help you? While she's getting worse, you know, I just don't trust Kate. But at this time,
no,
I know, right? How often do we hear like stuff like that? At this time,
I don't know. I trust homegirl.
Aaron, Kate, you're such a freaking Bell Witch apologist. I cannot believe it.
You're such a new ager. Get out of here.
But no, I can't wait to like discuss when we finish in a moment. Lucy lost her appetite, and Kate was oddly devastated by this. And family members started to try to find foods that would revive her. You know, it's like, oh, maybe we just have to find the right food. And you'll remember this, Nick. What comes here? Kate is like, oh, well, these family members are trying to find food. You know what? She says one day, Luce, how do you feel now, Luce? Hold out your hands, Luce. I'll give you something. And so Luce would stretch her hands out, and from the air, while she is inside in bed, hazelnuts would drop into her hands. Several people would witness this in astonishment, and they would spend the entire day searching for holes in the ceiling or some explanation, some source of how these could appear literally from thin air, and they would find nothing. And I want to say right here, I am telling you all of these details, like rapid fire, as if they're nothing. They are not written that way in the book. They are written in the tone of, I know how this sounds. This is crazy. I don't know what to tell you besides this is true and people witnessed it. So I want to make it clear. This is as crazy as it sounds. And the authors and the, you know, the family members that wrote this down, passed this down, acknowledge that. Lucy even said, oh, thank you. I can't crack these myself. I can't open these. And Kate would say, no problem. And in her hand, the nuts would be cracked open. One day, Kate randomly called out, who wants some grapes? Which is very funny. And before anyone could even answer, a huge bunch of wild grapes just fell into Betsy's lap in the middle of a crowd. And they were real. They were passed around. They were inspected. They were eaten. I personally don't eat the grapes.
Don't eat the food.
You don't have to tell me the drink.
Aaron, don't eat the grapes.
Oh, that's true.
I would
don't,
never.
Don't eat the bananas.
Don't eat bananas. Don't eat the grapes. Don't eat the walnuts or whatever. I don't know about you guys, but if I had objects apport, I would throw them away. And if they were food, I would throw them away faster. I would not put them in my mouth. I would not go, ooh, nom, nom, nom. That's insane to me that they would eat it.
It's like a worm infested apple.
Yeah, right? It's like, yeah,
Frank, yeah. You're wrong for that. Because you know what happens when you don't comply with Kate?
I mean, that's true. You do get slapped.
So how bad could the grapes be?
They're like, sure,
we'll eat the wrathful. Grapes.
The grapes of wrath? Nice. That's good. So now she's developed the ability, or revealed, I don't know. I don't know what you guys think, but the ability to apport objects. What the hell is this? Now, there are stories that I didn't see in this book, but are in other sources where she did this at even further distances, where people would just see stuff disappear from their homes, and they'd be like, the witch took it, and it would appear in the bell house. She did this with stockings that she just dropped as a gift into Jesse Bell's wife, Martha, her home, which was far away. Other people came, a wizard came who like was good at spells and stuff. I'm not even going to go with that story because you can imagine what happens. He got his butt kicked and ran away terrified. This is bizarre. Eventually, a physical manifestation of Kate was seen. Maybe. I'd love to know what you guys make of this. Back when Psypocrisy and crew, or rather I should say Black Dog and crew were around, one day, Esther Bell, one of the daughters, who was married to Bennett Porter, was outside her home gathering eggs when she saw a woman in the road walking up to her house. And so she ran from the field she was in up to her house to meet the lady just in time. And she recognized the woman as one of her neighbors. And so she said hello. But the woman made no reply, just completely ignoring her. So again, she said hello, and again, no reaction. Instead, the woman just paused in place in front of the house, took off her bonnet, which covered her hair, let her hair down, and began to comb it, looking very absorbed or deeply troubled by something. Esther invited her into the house, but again was ignored. Esther is confused. She thinks, is there something wrong with this lady? Is she crazy? Or did I insult her in some way or something? Like, what is going on? So she goes inside and fetches Betsy. Betsy and her come back out, and the woman is still standing there brushing her hair. And as they watch, this woman walks over to their fence and sits on a fence post and still continues to comb her hair. And this goes on for a few minutes until, again, as Esther and Betsy are watching, this woman gets off and walks through one of the fields on the girls' property. And as she passes around a large log, three other figures appear. Two girls and one boy.
It's the gang.
It's the gang, maybe. They each sat on a sapling of the log, bouncing up and down, like the little girl at the very, very start way back. As Esther and Betsy are watching this excitedly, Bennett Porter, who was out for the day, came home and found the commotion. And he's like, whoa, what's going on? What's going on? And they're pointing at the field and telling him, and he's looking and he's like, what are you talking about? I don't see anything. And he looks closer and all he sees are the saplings on the log moving up and down. But he doesn't see the figures. But the two ladies can see the figures. He runs in to grab his gun to shoot them. He's like, those are damn witch apparitions. So he takes his gun out. The women point. They're like, there, like point, like, you know, shoot right on the log, like that sapling to the left. He shoots, hits right where he wants. You know, they don't see anything. They don't notice anything. The figures seem to disappear. And now Bennett and the two ladies run over to the log and they find nothing. No sign of anything, really. But that night, back at the Bell House, Kate and the witch family made a big stink complaining about Bennett Porter having shot Jerusalem and breaking his arm with the bullet. They're like, what the hell? Why'd he shoot at us?
Couldn't even see you.
So, as we move towards the end of the stories here, I want to reiterate that there are so many more that I encourage you to read in the book. But I want to focus on the promise Kate made to John Sr. All the while as this was going on, John Bell Sr. continued to suffer with the spells of twitching and jerking and stiffness of his face. This grew worse and worse over the months. And Kate grew more and more violent in her verbal attacks on John, and it came to a point where she would almost never leave him in peace. I mean, he would walk. He'd be walking outside with his son, Richard Williams, and his shoes would be yanked off and tied really tight and shoved back on as he's walking. He'd be slapped across the face, taunted, as he tried to work around the property with his son attending him. Eventually, it came to a point where one day, after suffering all this abuse, he turned to his son. This is just sad. He said, oh, my son, not long will you have a father to wait on so patiently. I cannot much longer survive the persecutions of this terrible thing. It is killing me now by slow tortures, and I feel that the end is nigh. He prayed desperately for the affliction to pass him, for the suffering to stop. And after that, for a time, he had a little burst of renewed strength and courage. And when he got home that day, he immediately got into bed to rest. And while he would move about a bit, he would never leave his house alive again. Seemingly reconciled to his fate, he gradually declined in health, with his wife and family and friends constantly tending to him by his side. And on December 20th, 1820, he was found comatose in his bed, not really able to wake up as his family was kind of waking up for breakfast, shaking him. And one of the sons ran downstairs to see if they could fetch any of the medicine vials that they thought one of the doctors that had been tending him had left. And they opened a cabinet and they saw a vial of some strange black smoky liquid. They looked at it and they're like, well, we don't recognize this. What is this? Is this one of the medicines? And they immediately sent for the doctors just to find out. But they heard the voice of Kate cackle and say, it's no use. He's not waking up. Like I said, I promised to get him. I got him. And when asked what she did, she said, I fed him half of that vial in the middle of the night. He's not waking up. And it said that they could smell the scent of something, and it matched the scent of the vial, the weird liquid. And one of the sons took that vial and threw it into the fire, and it burst into this very strangely colored flame. And he died, John Bell Sr., later that day. I won't go into too much detail about the aftermath. There's a whole lot of more stuff that happens after this year. In fact, the Bell Witch didn't immediately leave, but promised to return to haunt the family in 7 years. And true to its word, it did. And there are more stories to come from that. But the last I'll say is what happened to Betsy. After John Bell Sr. died, there was a gloom over the family for many months, and everyone in the community found it really hard to move on. And Betsy and Josh Gardner were moved further and further into depression as they realized the Bell Witch was not going to let them get married. It was going to follow and harass Betsy till she died if she didn't give up marrying Josh Gardner. To his credit, Josh Gardner was more courageous and wanted to fight it and wait it out and promised to wait as long as she needed and hoped it would just go away. And there were moments where it quieted down and Kate seemed to have left and they'd be happy together. And then it would show up again and just incessantly repeat, please don't marry Josh Gardner. Please don't marry Josh Gardner. Please don't marry Josh Gardner. It came to a point where they were engaged with a ring, and the abuse became so bad that Betsy had to break it off with her love and return the ring. And it was a devastating, devastating, devastating event for both of them. So Kate kept her promise of killing old Jack. She destroyed the relationship of Betsy Bell. And Joel, the youngest son, who was also physically abused a lot, lived the rest of his life in solitude on the farm with pretty much what we would call PTSD now, becoming a hermit, totally terrified that Kate would show up and haunt him later in his life as it did his father. As I said, there are stories about what happened in the 7 years later, and even the prophecy that was made about it returning in 100 years. And there are many, many more legends that have spawned around the original story, including that of the Bell Witch Cave, which is now a kind of tourist center that you can pay to go through. Seems to be well reviewed. And there are legends there. But all of those came decades, if not centuries, after the original story, the original events. That is the end of the Bell Witch tale. A dark and harrowing end. I don't know what lessons are learned, but many generations of Bells lived and passed this tale down before they felt finally comfortable of sharing it with the world. But it was witnessed by hundreds of people all over the area and surrounding states, and has really cemented itself in Southern United States folklore at this point. With that, I'd like to finish this two-parter with, what do you guys make of this?
All right, I've been waiting. You're not gonna like it.
Uh-oh.
I need you, Aaron. You obviously are in tune with stuff, but Frank just has heard so many more than even me. So I need the both of you to just think. Really think of all the stories you've heard with all different phenomena. This is unique. This is its own like thing. You've never heard like this is very, very specific. We've heard stories with ghosts and poltergeists and demons, and they're not like this. Which leads me to believe it's not those things. And really, genuinely, I think this time around, some tulpa thing was created. And I am actually pulling the psychic phenomenon card here. Think, I want you to just think of all the things that lined up. A bit. Yeah, let me finish. a big family with a lot of kids going through puberty. Very common for phenomena to happen revolving around kids at that time. And now it's like, you know, is conflated, compounded. Betsy, I don't know if she's the oldest. Maybe she's the oldest daughter.
I think she was the youngest daughter, actually.
Youngest daughter. Okay.
She was like the belle of the family.
Yeah. But now she's going through puberty and it's centering around her. So, you know, very common. Joel, also the youngest boy. So it's seems to be, you know, focusing on the youngest of the genders here. The other thing is they lived in North Carolina and moved there whenever. And you even said the story with the bone and everything. That's probably not true. Why did it take so many years to happen? They weren't doing anything. They're devout Baptists, so we know they're not doing the things that normally invite this stuff in. Why did it happen? I just think that we don't know how the family dynamic actually was. There could be some trauma that gets compounded with the puberty aspect here with such a large family. So many emotions are intermingled and more people get involved. So there's more thought and focus being put on it. So how do you think the Bell Witch knew all these things about the people? Well, all these people are constantly thinking about it. So it's like their subconscious thoughts are a part of this tulpa, and the tulpa is like a representation of everybody involved, and that's why it knew everything. That's why it could recite the sermons, because in their memory, the reverends knew, like, could probably recall what they said, but they were so involved in this, like, soup of emotions that it all kind of amalgamated into this thing. And now you might be like, oh, what about the apports and the other phenomena? That's also just could be so much like concentrated human emotion and subconsciousness is in this one point that this incredible psychic phenomena is occurring. So even the skeptics, their mind is being added into the equation. So that's what I think happened, because it's a great story. It's one of my favorite stories. But listening to so many other experiences over the years since I started listening to this stuff in like 2018, maybe 2019, nothing of any sort of like elemental, fae, demon, nothing like that has everything that the Bell Witch has.
It's pretty unique. It's pretty
insane. It doesn't fit. And so that just, I mean, just because it doesn't fit doesn't mean it's not like a poltergeist or whatever. But because it's so far off and so different, I think it is a large scale psychic phenomena and like a tulpa that amalgamated hundreds of people's thoughts.
That's not what I thought you were going to say, but I mean, no, you make
that's what I think.
So I guess it's to take it a step even further back.
Wait, let's do the astonishing legends thing. Assuming you believe any of this,
where are you?
That is what I think.
Where are you in what percentage, given the stuff I said, the stuff that's reported in this book, and how do you feel about the veracity of the statements?
When people have experiences, unless it's like legit, like actually crazy, like incredibly, like, yeah, I went to Mars and saw Jesus. Like, I'm not going to believe that.
And people say that.
And people, that's probably something someone has said. I tend to believe if people are having a paranormal or supernatural experience, it might not be paranormal or supernatural. It could be subconscious, could be, I'm not saying a hallucination, but like people generally, I think, experience something, whether it's supernatural, I don't know. This, I wouldn't call tulpas supernatural. It is in Tibetan teachings. It's very spiritual and human, like kind of like a sixth sense sort in that kind of area.
It's like a natural phenomena, you're saying?
Yeah, something that we just like don't like control on a regular basis, but you can like hone the skill, i.e. the Tibetan monks, e.g. whatever the proper thing is there. So I think these things happened. I don't think, I mean, it is over 200 years old, so like, and it's all from the family. There might be some hidden things about the family we don't know.
I will say maybe there was never, you know, like the Fox sisters, decades later, one of them or two of them were like,
oh yeah, it was fake.
That never happened with any of this. There were never any people that said,
yeah,
I was represented wrongly in that book. That's not what happened.
I don't think
none of the family ever reneged ever.
I don't think they're lying. Like they probably experienced something in general. If someone has an experience, I'm not going to say no, that didn't happen to you. Again, unless it's just like absolutely insane, like the super soldier stuff and that kind of thing. So I think this happened to an extent. I mean, also it could have been, some stuff could be hyperbolized. Like we can't discount that is the case.
Yeah,
but I think that this phenomenon occurred, but I don't think it was supernatural in a way, because of the encounters I've heard that I think, something supernatural happened or something that fits the bill of like a ghost or something, that I'm like, okay, yeah. This does too many. This does like everything. Like it checks every box, which no other story has ever done. Even my favorite MU story, where it involves like a demonic entity.
Yeah, it's pretty contained, right? Like the phenomena.
It's not this. It has some like things knowing where they are and stuff like that, but nothing close to this. So I genuinely think this is just like so much emotion was happening at this time, through reasons we might not ever be told.
Yeah. And this is a fraction of the stories in the book, and the book is a fraction of the stories that are claimed to happen. And there are a lot that, on that note of emotion, there are so many stories in this book about very high anxiety and emotional moments. There's a whole section at the end where it's stories passed down by the slaves.
Mm-hmm.
It really,
that's a whole other thing. We don't know even how well
the
slaves were treated necessarily. That adds to it.
yeah,
in their beliefs as well.
Oh, I'm just gonna say the words used to refer to the slaves. It's so bad. And the way that they transcribe how they speak makes it almost impossible to understand. And it's like,
they like make them sound like dumb.
Oh my God. It's actually so, because I'm like, you know what they're saying because you are transcribing it to be unintelligible. I can't read this. It's really interesting. Like they really
just being racist for the sake of being racist.
Yeah. Like they are choosing to make it unintelligible. But you could trying to piece those stories together, skim them. There are many more hands-on physical and emotional stories from them that just add to, I think, kind of your perspective, maybe. I don't know.
So that's my soapbox sponsored.
So, I'm here to poke some holes and add some info. So first off, Frank, that excerpt that you had sent before about like, and you alluded to of, oh, they made it sound so unintelligible. There's actually in English class, I read a pretty interesting book that was written in a similar fashion. Called Their Eyes Were Watching God. I forget the premise, but it kind of, you know, had the same diction and syntax kind of layout. I don't know. I don't want to say the wrong term in fear of getting canceled by our one listener.
Nick's mom. Nick's mom will be like, what the hell?
Nick's mom is going to tell me something.
Can't believe you said that.
But yeah, it's written almost like it's a different language.
Yeah, definitely.
Or dialect.
That's a good way to put it.
I don't know if it was necessarily meant to be derogatory or if it was just
that's how they talked.
That's how they talked, so that's how they captured it.
I guess we'll never
know. That's interesting.
We'll never know.
Yeah.
That's true. I also Nick, want to ask you or pose just a hypothetical question.
I do love hypotheticals.
The average number of children that women had in 1800, and this is just a quick Google search, 7.
7, okay.
So 9's not that crazy.
We need it's the standard like, deviation.
And they 15. Lost one, so I guess there were 8 living at the time.
I thought it was 10 and then they lost one.
I believe it was 9 and they lost one.
Oh my God.
Their names are cool. It's like Zadok and you heard a bunch of them, Esther and Betsy and Joel.
It's so, the kid. Anyway, sorry, Aaron. Continue.
So it's not the 8 isn't that crazy. Even 9 is not super crazy. Like it's above average, but it's not like crazy and unheard of. So why this family? Why not like every other family?
Because it's
not like they're in a unique situation.
I think what the whole thing with the large family is also, I guess we don't know the what's the respawn rate. We don't know how fast they were pumping them out, you know? So All I mean with like they have a large family is there could have been a lot of the kids going through those puberty stages at one time.
I suppose. I don't believe it's atypical.
I'm also why this family. I don't want to cast aspersions on the deceased. But we don't know. There are rumors, like Frank said, of John might not being this saintly father. And there could just be things that, like, why is John the, you know, the most hated? Why? There might just be something we don't know. And I think that might be more likely than not just because of the sheer hatred constantly for 3 years. So I think maybe that has to do with that. But it is odd, like, yeah, why this family? And it goes back to my point. Why did it happen at one point while they lived there? They lived there for a while. Like, you know, in the horror movies, you move in and stuff happens pretty quickly. It doesn't happen 5 years after you move in. So that's why I'm thinking, as the kids were growing up, maybe in like things, maybe there are some other things at home that weren't pleasant, that all of that emotion, whether it be the kids or the slaves, kind of manifested into this entity and stuff started happening. And more people got involved, and it just exacerbated it.
I'll also add, there's a lot of religious energy at this time.
And they're on a river.
True. True.
Waterways are very common in folklore of kind of being an avenue for like energy and phenomena occurring on or near.
Yeah, that's true. There's water. I think that that religious fervor really came through in the book. I think it's not familiar to us in the 21st century. I mean, these people would spend a good chunk of their day like ecstatic,
shaking,
praying, singing with each, like with their neighbors, with their entire family together. It wasn't a private thing that, you know, maybe you pray like at the end of the day in like a corner of the house. It was like a part of the fabric of life. And like the revival meeting, those meetings would go on for multiple days. So I don't know.
I could see that. The question I have about tulpas, because I don't fully understand. Mm-hmm. So I understand it's energy being invested. Is it the type of energy? Because this seemed like a very negative spirit.
It's thoughts. Entity. A tulpa, and again, I'm not well versed in Tibetan practices. And I'm sure a thought form entity exists in other cultures. But it is just you think about something with so much intent that a form is created. So if there are some negative things happening and that gets compounded with typically like phenomenon happening around children that are aging and becoming teenagers and going through puberty, you combine all that into this manifestation, and then activity manifests around it. Poltergeist activity is how it starts, right? It doesn't start super crazy. It starts with poltergeist activity, which is associated with young children a lot of the time. And so with all this happening, now more and more people are experiencing the activity, and now they're thinking about it because now they're, like Frank said, people are in the house all the time, talking about it, thinking about it. It's so much intentional thought that it manifests and gets in. It's getting stronger. Why do you think it now talks and now it can apport things? There's just so much thought going into it.
I don't know. It just, to me, it's a little odd. Like, where is the negative aspect coming from? Like, why is it so negative?
I am making the assumption that we are not being told the full story of the family dynamic and the slaves as well.
But even so, then why has it never come out in the 200 years that
that's a good question. It's all, and that's like, the
none of the ancestors.
That's the other
thing. It seems like if the energy is coming from the family, you would think at least one of them would be like, yeah, you know, dad was pretty abusive or dad did this or whatever.
I don't know. It goes back to my first thing I said at the beginning. They lived in North Carolina for a time with slaves, and then they moved to Tennessee and lived in that house for however many years before this all happened. I don't have an explanation for that, but if you're saying it's not some tulpa thing and it is like an entity, then the same question is posed to you. Why did it never show up before? Why now? My explanation is now enough of the kids are growing up and maybe some things are happening that we're not being told about, or something is happening more, or like maybe John is, as he's getting older, is becoming more like disdainful, or like is more rough with his slaves, and that's where the negativity is coming from. But what do you think? If it's not some type of thing, it's a demon or a ghost.
I think it's ghosts.
But why now?
So, trickster spirits, Nick.
Well, yes.
We love trickster spirits. Why not sit dormant for a few years, observe the dynamic so that you can pick it apart and know like who to target? Like, the trickster spirit goes after what I'm assuming are the favorite children, or the weakest children, I guess, because they're youngest. Yeah. And so it's just sitting back, observing, learning, and then all of a sudden it's ready to strike.
So do you think it was always just sitting in Tennessee waiting for a family to move there, or did it follow the family since they started having kids in North Carolina?
I mean, I think given that they said they dug up graves, you know, that could have something to do with the awakening.
Right. But that was a few years in the past. And I guess that is what you're saying, that they waited. But in my experience from what, like the stories we've listened to over the years, I haven't heard of like you dig up a Native American like burial mound 3 years later, now stuff happens to you. I mean, I haven't heard that before.
That's fair. But to be fair, again, we haven't heard stuff that's this crazy
before. Right. But counterpoint, in the stories involving the Native American burial grounds, nothing gets this crazy. Why did it get this crazy this time? What makes this one special? If it's just a plain old ghost or a trickster spirit or something, why this story in particular, is it so much more physical and involved, and there's so much more phenomena that's not just associated with a ghost? Why is that happening in this instance, but not in any of the other stories of poltergeists or like fairy encounters that we've heard in the past?
I see that. I
see that. I raise you.
I raise you. There's multiple ghosts. It's not just one. I think there's multiple spirits. They've seen multiple entities, or rather heard multiple entities. And I think these spirits colluded, plotted together, came up with some devious plan. And also, you wonder, how could these spirits be seemingly omniscient and know all these things? Well, if you could be in multiple places at once by being multiple entities, it's a lot easier to come up
so
with.
You think
stuff.
It was a band of ghosts?
Yes.
Black Dog, Mathematics, Jerusalem, and Cypography.
Yeah.
Well, they didn't show up till later, though.
Multiple spirits. Okay, that doesn't mean they weren't there. That does not mean they weren't there.
Maybe.
Just because you don't see them, hear them, doesn't mean they're not there doing stuff. Like, I'm sure there's plenty of spirits around us right now, and we would have no idea.
I would,
unless they wanted to make themselves.
I would also like to point out that my tulpa thought form idea also partially explains why it followed Betsy. Because I'm saying it's tied to her going through puberty to an extent. So if that's true, of course it's going to follow her. You heard that in the story we did last 2 weeks ago for my my episode about the Encyclopedia of Spirits and Ghosts, there were the haunting stories, but it was kind of weird where when she was at the house, like I think Esther was her name. When she was at the house, there was stuff, but when she was gone, there was nothing at the house, but we don't know if anything followed her. It never said, but always when she came back, it happened. So maybe there it's tied to her and the house, but I don't think it's tied to the house in this instance. I think it's tied to the people. Because also nothing ever happened at someone else's house.
That's
except
not true.
When the family was there. The whole...
That's not true. The snake. Invisible snake. That had nothing to do with the family.
What was? Wasn't he adjacent to the family?
He was maybe... Like, he knew the family.
He was a friend of the
everybody
family.
Everybody in town knows everybody.
But if he was someone like, who was involved in, like, never left their side during when all the really, really crazy stuff was happening...
I think it was someone kind of close to the family.
Damn. Okay. Well, you know, I don't know what to say to that.
I don't know. I like it's so much weird phenomena that is all happening at once that yes, it could be a bunch of entities masquerading as like one or five if you include the witch family. And it could just be the five, it could be more, could be less, I don't know. But for the most part, it all centered around the family and people who, like, I mean, the skeptics, of course. But it just seemed so centered around the family, not even the home. It was centered around the family and people close to the family. So I think there might just have been stuff that we're not being told. And it created this because nothing happened for how did it? Did you say, Frank, how long, like when they moved to Tennessee?
It was 13. It was 1804. And then the activity started in 1817.
So they lived there for 13 years and nothing happened? Seems a little odd.
Okay, but when did they disturb the grave?
It is not provided, but at some point between those years.
I think it said a few years?
Yeah.
But still, I've never heard of a story where someone disturbs a grave and then several years later, now the whole family is affected. Also, the kid, the Corbin kid who threw the bone... He's never brought up or has any, it's never said that he experienced anything. And he's the one that,
is he even mentioned?
He threw the bones and broke them. So right. Why wouldn't he be, I guess if he was haunted, we'll never know.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like maybe he's off in some other town being haunted as well.
But still, it is odd for that to happen and then years later there is phenomena. I'm trying to find it in the notes where when he said the Corbin Hall.
I don't know. I think it's I do
oh, it just
agree,
said some years
I
ago.
I think we're kind of getting at the same point with having different mechanics.
I don't think it was supernatural.
Because we... Okay, well, what would you classify? Would you just call it psychic?
Yeah, it's some, like, psychic... Like, it's paranormal, if anything. Assuming the definition of supernatural is it can't ever be explained and it's beyond our understanding, and paranormal is just something we haven't yet been able to figure out. And I classify psychic stuff as paranormal.
See, I would disagree there, but I think we're splitting hairs a little. But what I was going to say is because we don't really understand the mechanics, hence paranormal or supernatural, you know, it's kind of tough. We're trying to put it in a box of something, but we don't know what the box looks like or how big it is or what color
it
is.
Or if you crush up a rock, how much you can fit in there.
Exactly. whatever that means.
Anyway.
I mean, whatever that means.
We're
that
trying
was very clear.
Is a callback to your pyramid episode.
Yeah, I'm saying my point made during the episode was very clear.
No.
Oh, sure. Okay. Whatever. We don't know how to explain these things, so like we're trying to put a label on something without knowing what the label is.
I mean, that's what a theory is. It's fine for us to both think something differently.
No, I'm not saying it's not. I'm just saying it's tough to really come to a conclusion with this because we don't know, like, we're speculating.
You can't test any of these.
The mechanics of a tulpa.
Yeah, we can't.
Well, and not even that, but like, we don't know what tulpas are capable of, how they're caused. Like, we have an idea. We've kind of come up with this notion. But we don't know the mechanics of it. We don't know the mechanics of spirits and how they work, why they work, what they do. So I think I hate to be like, oh, well, I don't know what it is, but
you don't know what it is.
I don't know what it is. Like, we could both in a way be right, and there's some connection between spirits and tulpas that we have not yet discovered or understand.
Maybe. I think, well, I said my piece that it's tulpas.
You think
that it could be like a band of spirits. Frank, you researched this. What do you think?
Guys,
what do you think of, do you think Frank or Aaron and I are dummy idiots?
No, honestly, you know, usually I do. Outside of this Frank, podcast, well, yeah. I think you guys are. And so am I. But all I know, these are the things that disturb me the most, and I think factor into what this was. One, attention, insane amounts of attention fed into this over years by people. I just don't believe that can't. I just believe that plays a part, and whatever this is, it plays a part. That can go to either of your guys' theories. I think more maybe Elin starts to, but like, also when you give other things attention, they
true. When you look, it looks back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When you give a mouse a cookie,
yes,
that's a book, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Also, for what it's worth, it was William Porter, or Billy, who got into bed, or who was in the bed, and he was very close to the family and like a very well-respected guy who I presume was related to Bennett Porter, who shot Jerusalem in the arm.
Right.
So I think there's something with the attention. I think there's something about the religious fervor the region. That energy, like, that is spiritual energy put in, just in the community, in the area, in the home. So those two things, the insane levels of attention and openness and like curiosity and engaging with it, and the spiritual attention. And I don't know. So I think those are the two things that the two factors, I think, that cause this. I think those two factors make it a rare combination, right?
To use Aaron's question, with the attention and the religious fervor, why do you think it ended up being so negative? I have my reasons. Aaron has his reasons. Your reason?
I do think I lean towards it more being like a negative entity. Because I find it hard to believe that like the combination of all of everyone's energies would be so evil.
I'm making a big jump that there is some dark thing that we don't understand. I hope there isn't.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to say that this family was a terrible.
No, sure, sure.
Family. I'm just thinking that, you know, like I said, so much phenomena happened that I haven't heard of happening at one point except right here. So if it is a tulpa and it's all this psychic manifestation, there has to be some negative thing that we just haven't heard.
Yeah. I really
but I hope that's not true.
Yeah, likewise. As you guys are saying, There's just nothing like this that was this long and this repeated and this physical and verbal. Years. I mean, any one of these stories taken would be like a spooky story. Like the kids are walking to and from home and they have sticks and stones thrown at them and they're tripped and like the stones are marked and they're thrown. But that's just like a little offhand comment in this story.
That's usual. That's typical.
That's typical. They were like, oh, this is funny. Oh, it's just the witch. It makes me not want to believe that this happened at all because it stretches. It's so incredulous. But at the end of this book are just a bunch of people who are still alive by the time this was published saying, this is true. This happened. I was there. My family, my parents were there. They confirmed this, whatever. We swear by this. This is, you know, this is not making anything up. This doesn't portray itself as something that, you know, is folklore. Folklore developed after this and filled in stuff and like made up stories. But all I know, I was kind of saying what Aaron said, I don't know, but this happened. These things happened.
I agree.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think it was a hoax.
No, I don't think so either. I tend to not
think. I just don't know why, as you guys are saying, like,
people's lives get ruined more often than not when they talk about this stuff. Yeah. There's no way they're hoaxing it. No. There are some, of course.
The guy, the dad died, like, and the daughter, who everyone thought was faking it, had her life ruined. She ended up marrying someone else, I think, like some professor or something. But
oh, whoa.
They were so devastated. They did not. Nobody wanted this.
Yeah. And like you said, John did die.
Yeah. But just the fact that it targeted him and also the Bible stuff gave me such a weird feeling. It makes me feel like it's just like a negative, I don't know, some really negative entity that stumbled upon like an infinite fountain of energy. Do you know what I mean?
I just, I find it hard to believe it.
I know.
It just got there.
I know. It doesn't make any sense. I know.
You don't hear that, right? It doesn't just.
And why does it care about the? I don't know.
I
that's
think
all whole, we're left with.
How does it
I
know so much?
I think the whole religion thing and it being able to recite like scripture goes back to my point of it's like.
But people couldn't
absorbed.
They couldn't do that as well as she could. So how does that? How do you explain that?
Think about it this way. If you've read like it, back then, also probably. And even now, Protestants, like, they quote the Bible a lot, right? Isn't that a common thing? And back then, reverends probably knew a lot of the Bible. Maybe not right away.
Like,
but
you're saying it amalgamated everyone? And like,
yes, I genuinely think
that's
like,
so interesting.
And that's why it was able to recite things.
But it's got a personality. It's got a sense of humor. How do you explain that? It just happens to everyone combined together has like a mean sense of humor. And like nicknames for people.
Yeah. I mean, it could be some like repressed, like because they're so religious, there are some emotions and humors that they don't let out in public. And it is kind of in that subconscious. Yeah. And then it came out to.
What do you make of it being female too? Having a delicate feminine voice.
Maybe just it's soothing.
Yeah. I don't know.
That I don't really know.
It makes it seem so innocent because women were innocent, fragile beings.
Unless you were Kate.
Where they were considered.
Yes.
And
so
then,
it's Kate Batts.
Yeah.
Then this trickster entity or entities decides, okay, well, I'll lure them into a false sense of security, being like, oh, it's just a fragile woman, you know, don't pay much mind to it, and kind of be like, nah, I'm actually an evil, powerful being that's gonna prey upon
I don't know
me.
It's I think we're at, we're at the point where I think all three of us, maybe just me and Aaron, because we're like explicitly stating it, I think we're using the two cop-out answers, like a generic trickster spirit versus Tulpa. Like what, like that, that's what we're just arguing here.
I guess, cause as like Aaron was saying, like, we don't really know, I guess we don't know the actual, those are blurry definitions for things that might not have strict boundaries.
Yeah.
Or we just don't
know. Yeah, we don't know the boundaries. We don't know if there are boundaries. We don't know if there actually are separate categories of things.
True. It could all just be, it could just be one thing.
Yeah.
Could be could be Supreme Leader Zorth. Yeah. Who knows?
Or there could be a billion different kinds of these things that range from.
And this is the one time something like this showed up in American folk history.
I know. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense.
No, I'm saying if there are a ton, like who knows? It's just.
I don't know.
There's so many times like listening to MU where it's just like Aaron or Ben will say, oh, low level entity. And it's like, what does that actually mean?
No.
And now we're like hearing us talk about it. It's like, okay, I said Tulpa. And like my definition and like,
yeah, we go,
of
okay,
what I know with this, like the psychic phenomena and the thoughts and everything. Okay, Tulpa. But then it's like, it does have trickster things. So it's like, but then it's like, okay, trickster spirit. What is that?
Yeah,
so I think Aaron's right. It's like you can say whatever, but it's like.
Guys, I'll end this debate right here, right now.
It's David Hoy.
It's a cow on a ladder.
There it is. I believe that.
Well,
I mean, the chain's rattling. That's just the ladder.
It's moving the ladder.
That's actually so wise. The dog's barking and fighting. It's cows.
Yeah.
That's also the ladder.
Yeah. The reason it's a female voice.
Cows, that's true.
The handprints.
Hoofs. Hooves. Oh, well, if it was hooves, we've had a bigger problem.
That's true. Oh, true.
We have a way bigger problem. But that's my piece. That's.
Gentlemen, I appreciate the energy. I wish Kate was here. She'd have opinions on this. She'd probably laugh at us. And
I don't think you do either.
I want to end on
one thing,
but first I'll, like to thank everyone for listening to this two-parter. This was really fun to research and record. I wanted to do this forever. I hope you two enjoyed. I hope the listeners enjoyed. You know the shtick. Go to the show notes. Look at all the sources. I'll put pictures there too. There are a lot of really cool, like old style. I don't know what the word is. A word for these, not paintings, but drawings of different, yeah, illustrations. Of lots of these different events, which are really fun. So I'll include those. Cool. Leave us a review and like on all the platforms. And at the end of the day, I think all we can take away from this story is that Betsy deserved it. Good night, guys.
That's what you end on?
No, I just want to see how you guys react.
Oh my gosh.
No matter how amply corrugated you feel speaking to spirits, beware. Simple as that. Good night.